Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the hell happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war, before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated history episodes, and we also have episodes where we sit down with historians, filmmakers, authors, politicians, and we talk about wars in history. Today's guest is Katja Hoyer. She is a German-born British historian and journalist. She is a visiting research fellow at King's College London and a fellow of the Royal Historical Society, which is really impressive. And she's written multiple publications and co-hosts the podcast The New Germany. And she is also author of today's book, which is widely acclaimed. It's called Blood and Iron, The Rise and Fall of the German Empire, 1871 to 1918. Katja, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so you know all about, you're actually from Germany, and you're really a good person to talk to about what it feels like, kind of the German psyche a little bit. Can you set it? So you open up in 1815. Why 1815? Let's just start with that. Set the table a little bit.
Yeah, I cheated a bit there because on the book cover it says that I start in 1871, which is when Germany is basically founded as a country. Yeah. But I sort of felt when I was thinking about how to write the book that I had to go back a little bit because I just can't understand how that country has come about without going back to 1815 at least. And this is because basically before that time, Germany didn't really even exist as a concept. There were just over 400 little sort of states and city-states and kingdoms and principalities and it was like a patchwork of German-speaking sort of political entities on the map. And then Napoleon comes along and basically the French emperor needs these spaces and thinks to himself that this isn't exactly easy to control or to hold, to try and negotiate with all of these little sort of rulers and kings and so on. Yeah. And so he basically sums this entire area up into slightly larger units. He comes up with 38 states in the end, and basically that's easier to manage. And so this is really the first moment you get some sort of sense of German unification, ironically brought about by Frenchmen. But it is an important moment, and it also gives the Germans the idea that because they end up 1815 beating Napoleon in a sort of grand coalition in which Prussia was the sort of leading military power, but they're fighting together against Napoleon, and this is basically setting the scene really for what we see later, this idea that Germans are stronger when they're fighting together. And it's an idea that we'll see kind of time and time again.
Yeah, and it's so interesting. So you bring up Napoleon, right? And so they're like, okay, that the whole French Revolution really freaked everybody out in Europe, all the major powers. They're like, wow, this could come for us. And then now you have, fast forward a little bit, now you have the German states kind of unifying, and it freaked them out a little bit again. The major powers in Europe. Can you tell us a little bit about their reactions from those major powers as Germany unified? Was it scary for them?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly was, in the sense that it completely threw this very fragile power balance that you had in Europe. People sometimes call it the concert of Europe because it was so finely tuned, all of these different players in it, basically, that it just about kept the peace. The Brits always thought of the sort of balance of power, and suddenly Germany unifies right in the center of all of this and creates the single largest state in Europe, on the continent. And that, of course, overnight, you know, completely throws this power balance out of kilter, and people are worried about that, and especially France, because this is actually based on anti-French sentiment at this point. Germans haven't got much to unify them at this stage other than their language, but that's a very vague, hazy, nice to have sort of thing. You know, what really unifies them is that they're worried about French aggression. It does help that the second time around in the 1860s, the French ruler is once again a Napoleon III, And so really you kind of play on all of these anxieties and the hostilities, and that's what unifies Germans at this point. So yes, the rest of Europe is quite worried about that.
Yeah. And so like Prussia was a big deal before Germany became a country, and it kind of got absorbed into Germany a little bit. Was it kind of like trading a smaller big power for this like crazy big German power all of a sudden? Like a difference there.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost the other way around. So Prussia basically wanted to expand its influence over the other German states, and it assumed that there was only so much you could do by kind of forcing the other states into its remit. And it did that. So some of them were just annexed just by the sheer kind of, you know, military power that Prussia had. Yeah. But it also wanted to make sure that it could expand its influence over the entire kind of German-speaking world in Europe. And the way to do that was unify Germany, but under leadership, so that basically some people even call it Prussia Germany, this kind of first German state.
Yes.
It is basically run by Prussia.
And that kind of adds to the... Occasionally on the podcast, Prussia comes up, and it's always this funny kind of thing of, well, what the hell even is Prussia? Is it a kingdom? Is it an area? Is it a state? And it's kind of all of it. But now we're talking about Prussia, Germany, and it just gets like these layers of confusion for people not from that area. I feel like so. Depends on when you're talking about. That's Prussia was a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, the easiest way to think about it just in one sentence is just that it's the northern part of Germany effectively, and it stretched all the way along the Baltic coast into what is now Poland and a bit of Russia as well, but it was the northern stretch of continental Europe really where it was. It doesn't help that it was actually destroyed and kind of, you know, it's not there anymore, so people don't really have a way of envisioning it today because it was abolished in 1947 after the Second World War.
Yes. And so you have all this kind of mishmash of people, maybe different cultures from the different states kind of unified a little bit, but you have, you know, Catholics, Protestants, industrializing areas mixed with rural areas. And did the German people at the time think, yeah, this will last, or were they kind of skeptical about that?
Well, most didn't feel that being German was sort of their first thing on their identity list. As you say, people would say, well, you know, I'm a Catholic, or I'm a Protestant, or I'm from the Rhineland, or I'm from Bavaria. You know, these were like their sort of points of identity. So it's not like 1871 comes and Germany is founded and everyone thinks I'm German now, first and foremost. But there was an overarching sense. This was mostly brought about by the idea that they were fighting other people to get there. So there were three wars of unification, and at each time, basically, you know, this kind of punched bigger and bigger until it was unified under the kind of name or label of Germany in 1871. So there is a sense that's part of their identity already, but really that has to merge over time. And the rulers, I think, Otto von Bismarck, the first German chancellor or sort of head of government, is quite aware of that. And he, I would say, similar to the US really in lots of ways, he does know that people are a bit wary of kind of centralized power. So he creates a federal state and says from the beginning, yes, you can still be Bavaria, and Bavaria will still exist as an entity, say, so does Prussia.
Yeah.
Within this construct, so you can be both Bavarian and German at the same time within this federal state, and that's how it works.
That's so interesting. And, you know, it seems like very normal that's how over in America, too, that's how our country people weren't like, we're American. They're like, I'm North Carolinian or I'm Georgian. Like, it was very much the same way. So it seems kind of normal to not identify with your country right off the bat. Let's talk a little bit about, so everybody knows World War One. There's kind of this like arms race a little bit, but we're before that. And I want to talk a little bit about Germany feeling like it's kind of beset by these larger entities and how that might have influenced their desire to arm themselves or get weapons or a military, kind of militarizing. How did that impact that feeling?
So basically, you know, we were talking about the idea that the other surrounding states aren't entirely happy about Germany being there. And so obviously Germany also realizes that in the center of Europe, and that if the other states were all to work together, this is again this kind of Napoleon trauma to some extent, then they're surrounding Germany. So this is called the nightmare of encirclement, or the idea of encirclement is that Germany basically surrounded by enemies. That's how people think of it. So what they obsess about is the idea, what happens if we are going to fight a two-front war one day, you know, and the idea is to avoid that. So they start wargaming, they start coming up with, you know, kind of a really strong push towards militarization and also to build a navy, which was not something that Germany or kind of German states, largely landlocked states, had previously invested a lot of thought into. So all of a sudden you get a massive buildup of military, of a naval program, and at the same time the elites and the military elites in particular start come up with plans as to what they would do if they were to go to war. So mentally they're getting themselves into a state where that's a normal, that one day they're going to get attacked, so they might as well prepare for it. And so you end up with a militarized society as a result.
Yeah, and it seems kind of natural for a newly formed country, but that would be awfully terrifying for France and Britain. That would definitely put them on edge. And can you talk a little bit about some of the, what readers might see, some of the struggles of a newly formed Germany, just kind of an overall picture of what they might see?
Yeah, so that this foreign political challenge is one of those. So the idea that, you know, they feel that they're surrounded by enemies. France was seen happy having just been defeated by Prussia and with the other German allies. So basically Otto von Bismarck, the Chancellor, realizes that, and he's driving a really strong peace policy, a really complicated network of kind of foreign political alliances, making some enemies, making some friends. He's very clever in building up this kind of European network that nobody else understands. So when he goes eventually after 2 decades pretty much in charge, then, you know, the whole thing collapses, and that's what leads up to the First World War. But that's one big challenge, is making this German thing survive that has just been created. And then the internal differences are also massive. So especially the religious divide is huge. So many Catholics, they only form about a third of the population. They feel that they're being attacked, and Bismarck actually does attack them because he's worried. Similar again, as happens in the US as well, there's this kind of idea that, you know, the Pope is interfering, and Catholics as strongly bound to the nation as they would be. What if the Pope says don't go to war, but your country says go to war, you know?
Right.
Then this idea that Catholics have got other sort of moral authorities elsewhere outside of the country, keeping Bismarck awake, so he fights the struggle against them. That's a big issue. Wealth divides are massive. It's an industrial revolution that is going on, so you have lots and lots of workers who move to the cities into terrible tenement housing, very small, cramped, damp, often flats that they live in, so social problems are huge. It's a mess, basically. So they need unifying factors, and that's what is Bismarck's priority, basically, to try and set up some sort of unified nation.
And for our listeners who might have heard of Otto von Bismarck, but not necessarily know a lot about, like, who he was, can you just give us an overview of who he was?
Yeah, so Bismarck was the first German chancellor, and is also the person who basically unifies under his own policies. He was previously the prime minister of Prussia, and then uses that position to try and unite Germany under Prussian leadership. So he's often, as much as Germany has a founding father, I guess he's it, in that he makes this whole thing happen. And he's also a bit of a, you know, sort of maverick, if you will. So he grows up basically being quite, he's the second son of a minor aristocrat. So initially he's totally like, what am I going to do with my life? I'm not going to inherit the estate, you know, and he tries to find a passion for a long time. And in the process, there's a lot of drinking and womanizing and gambling, and just gets lost a little bit. He's actually called the crazy Junker by his neighbors, as a word for Prussian aristocrat, and he's like the crazy one, basically. And then he's quite lucky in that a parliamentarian gets ill in the Prussian parliament. He's supposed to step in as the local aristocrat, and then he finds suddenly he absolutely loves the kind of, you know, backroom intrigues, the backstabbing, the forging alliances, the dirty business of politics, the house of cards kind of stuff. He loves that. And so basically comes home and says to his wife, do you know what, I've just found my calling. This is what I want to do in my life. And then you kind of see him climb up the political ladder. And eventually, because he is the one who unifies Germany, and the Prussian king is a little bit frightened about what's just been created. And he goes, do you know what? I want to be Prussian king, not German Kaiser. And Bismarck says, don't worry about it. I'll run the shop for you. And effectively, you know, being indispensable. Nobody would know how this Germany would basically work and operate live without him. And he knows it. So that's what human power for whole sort of first two decades of Germany.
So is that still a view held today, looking back in retrospect, that this German unification couldn't have happened without Otto von Bismarck?
Well, it could, but it would, and other people were pushing for it, but it wouldn't have happened when it happened and how it happened. So he himself said still in the 1860s, just a few years before it happens, he still says in a letter to a friend that he doesn't think that it's going to happen this century. So he himself thinks it's still going to be sort of decades off. And then when the opportunity arises to effectively provoke the three wars that end up unifying Germans against other countries, he takes it and provokes these wars and basically does that. That's why he's a bit of a controversial figure today. I mean, there are people, when I was at school, sort of in the 90s in Germany, he was still presented to me by teachers as a sort of political genius who, you know, brings all these things about. And because later on, he also introduces the welfare state, you know, unemployment and other things, health insurance, pensions, you know, they're all new things at this point, and he introduces them. So that's kind of often, you know, used as a means of saying modern Germany was created by him. But then also he does all of that basically by, as he puts it, blood and iron, which is why my book's called that as well. That's sort of his words, where he says, you know, we need to unify Germany, not by, you know, democratic niceties or by talking about things. We need to have war to unify the German people. And that's why he's a very controversial figure today. And also Germany acquires its first colonies when he's still in power. He doesn't like the idea. And says from the beginning, colonies aren't worth it. The world's already divided up between sort of Britain and France and the other colonial powers. And we're just going to aggravate everybody. But German industrialists just go ahead and buy plot land. And then suddenly they find out that actually the local people there don't really want to be run by a colonial power. So they're going to, you know, obviously rebel against it. And then they go and ask Bismarck for help and say, can the state please help us here and send out some soldiers and ships and things. And at that point, Bismarck steps in. So it's again something, you know, as Germany discovers its own version of the culture wars, that is now a bigger topic than it was.
Yeah, and I love how you talk about how he's controversial, because he really is, even today, where you go, okay, he did welfare and he's a unifier and he's got all this political acumen, if you want to not say genius, but you can say acumen. but he also is sometimes called authoritarian. And how is that viewed in Germany today? Do people think of him as a partially authoritarian figure?
Yeah, they do. I mean, there was a debate a few years ago around how democratic this state actually was that he created, because it is a halfway house, effectively. It does have a parliament, and that parliament, unlike in many other European states, is actually elected for by all men at this point. But again, that's normal. When I say normal, it's kind of the standard in the 19th century. But it is without class differences, without wealth differences. Every male's voice counts exactly the same. And they can all vote.
That's a big deal.
So
at that time,
it is a democratic parliament, basically, as democratic as it gets in the late 19th century. But that parliament is still headed by, or there's still a monarch basically sitting at the top of everything, the Kaiser, who's always the Prussian king. So that basically the head of state is still an unelected hereditary monarch. And that's the sort of balance. And the chancellor, so Otto von Bismarck himself, basically ends up as the mediator between these sort of old aristocratic elites, trying to keep them in power, trying to keep them their status, and giving the people as much democracy as they need so that they don't rebel, because that had happened several times in the 19th century. And even he's not a democrat himself at heart at all. He doesn't introduce this parliament because he thinks it's a good idea. He does it because he realizes otherwise you're going to have a rebellion on yours. So that's why he's so controversial. It's this kind of question of him just being cynical, really, kind of saying, oh, you know, the people need enough democracy to be pacified, but not so much that they actually get a kind of complete say.
Yeah, not quite a democracy, not quite a full monarchy. It's very interesting. And you know what's crazy is when you look around Europe in the first few decades of the 19th century, everything is in turmoil. There's so many revolutions and so many huge changes. How much of Germany going through its unifying first steps do you think kind of rippled out into causing other chaos in Europe around that time, do you think?
Well, some of the, I would say mostly before unification, some of the ideas that kind of come out of this German chaos and also the misery that, the Industrial Revolution has caused, have a huge impact. So you do have the idea that actually nation states are supposed to be liberal constructs. So the, you know, we have nationalism today as a right wing thing. But at the time, the whole point was to have a state so that the monarch doesn't have all the power, so that you can have a constitution that everybody needs to stick to. So then, you know, whether you're rich or poor, everybody sticks to the same laws. And for that, you need a space in which these laws apply. So the whole point at the time was that liberalism was a modern and liberal concept as well that comes out of that chaos. So I would say, yes, things that, happen kind of in the center in, of Europe and including Germany do kind of spill over and have a wide effect elsewhere.
All these revolutions everywhere, and just it's a wild few decades, the 19th century in Europe is wild. The more you look at different countries, you're like, here too? Really? But like, what is in the water? But that, I think it all kind of affected each other. So, all right, let's bring it closer to Wilhelm II, Bismarck and Wilhelm. Can you just give us a brief overview? Who was Wilhelm II?
Yeah, so when Bismarck unifies Germany, the Kaiser is Wilhelm I. So he is the first woman chancellor, Kaiser, so the emperor. And then he's very old, so people don't expect him to live very long, but he does, surprisingly. So he's already very, very old and then basically died in 1888. So he rules from 1871 to 1888. The idea is that it goes on to his son, Ludwig III, but he's very ill. He already has throat cancer by the time that he comes into power in 1888. And he can't even speak during his reign. He's that ill already. So people know that's not going to live long. Interestingly, though, that Frederick III is married to Queen Victoria's oldest daughter, Vicky. That's the English or British queen. And she has this idea of making Germany just as liberal as Britain is at the point. So it's getting kind of modernized. So she wants to bring in all of these liberal ideas from Britain and influence her German Kaiser husband to sort of implement them in Germany and within 100 days. And then it goes over to their son, rather, and that's Wilhelm II, therefore also Queen Victoria's oldest grandson. So that connection still stays and it's important for the First World War, because he does look to Britain as part of his, you know, sort of family, his horizon. And he always compares his own Germany to Britain and wants to sort of rival Britain in terms of its navy in particular. But that's basically why we are jumping one generation in 88. It's called the Three Kaiser Year, because you kind of go from Wilhelm I to Frederick, his son Frederick, and then to his grandson, Wilhelm II.
And, you know, without going too much into it, because I think people really should read the book, why didn't Bismarck and Wilhelm like each other very much?
Yeah, so, I mean...
To put it lightly.
I mean, Bismarck tries to set up this entire... I mean, let's not forget, he basically wrote the Constitution. He writes this for himself, and the idea is to... You have a Kaiser who's basically the head of the state, and then you got his manager, if you will, and that's the chancellor. So it meant like a shop owner and then the shopkeeper. That's how Bismarck sets it up. But you can't have them both having different ideas as to how to run the shop. They both have to be in unison. Ideally, Bismarck thought, I'm the manager, I run the shop, and the shopkeeper, the shop owner can basically just sit back and not get involved, you know, and just enjoy being the head in theory.
Sure,
he thinks the same. Well, it did work for about two decades, and then basically Wilhelm II takes over the shop and says, actually, I have a much better idea what we're going to do here. I want to reset everything. I want to run it in a different way. I want to rebrand it as well. And also, I don't need a manager. You know, and at that point, the two of them fall out with each other because Bismarck basically imagines, you know, Willem is young. He's only in his 20s. He imagines that he's going to be a mentor and father figure to him because he had been when he was a prince. And, you know, his father and his grandfather are dead. So the idea is that Bismarck, you know, who had just run the country successfully for that long, would kind of be the person really calling the shots and at the very least mentor Willem until he can do it himself. And Willem has other ideas. He's young, he comes in, he wants to do things differently. And so the two men clash and there isn't space in the system for the two people to run the country at the same time.
I can't imagine what would have happened if they were on the same page. How that could have affected World War One and all of that. And because Wilhelm really did, he had a chip on his shoulder too, you know, with the deformity and with feeling like, oh, I have to live up to my ancestors and this image of strong militarism. And that is interesting. I love how you describe it as a shopkeeper and the manager. That is so perfect to really understand these kind of complicated relationships. How would you say things were holding up with German identity by the time World War One breaks out?
I mean, Willem is a good example. He was a kid when Germany reunified, and he's really the first generation grew up with Germany being a normal thing. You know, for him, it was kind of always there. Yes, he has vague memory of the actual unification process, but really, by the time that he's a young adult, Germany was already a thing, a concept, and people who grew up in that generation, there's lots of them because the economy is soaring and so more and more people have children. You get a massive boom in the population. So there's many more young people than older people. And as a result of that, there's now a generation of young Germans who were born into the state and who think this is a normal thing. And they don't try and get their head around that. So that's naturally a process whereby kind of Germans feel more and more German at this stage because it's just there. It's the world that they grow up in. So by the time that 1914 happens, though, so when the First World War breaks out, Germans feel German, but they're still massively divided, particularly on wealth, because that doesn't go away. You still have a massive, massive working class in the cities. It's getting more politicized because socialism is in the air as an idea. You have a quite a socialist leaning social democratic party. They are reformist rather than revolutionary, so they just want to bring about change rather than actually having a revolution. But the idea is still around because there's only one wing party and everybody is in it. So that's about you've still got the old aristocracy panicking because they think, what about our status? We're getting sort of sidelined here. We're losing status and wealth. You've got the middle classes saying, we need the empire. We don't really care what other countries think about it. We want to carry on with that. So there's a huge clash there. And Willem sees the chance when war is sort of up in the air and it's sort of something, the tension is spilling over in Europe. He thinks this is a good moment to unify Germans once again, as it happened in 1815 and during the European Wars, to unify all these people together under the banner of being Germans first and foremost, rather than, you know, Bavarian or Catholic or an or a working class person. So he seizes that chance and thinks, let's now unite all under one banner. And they use this term called fortress peace, Friede, which basically is like a medieval phrase, the idea that if your castle gets attacked, or your fortress gets attacked, everybody in it needs a swabbling, and just everybody gets out and defend the castle because everybody has an interest in not being invaded. So that's effectively the spirit under which kind of Germans unite in 1914. And it seems to work initially. They will kind of agree. Trade unions, for example, immediately agree to just say, okay, we'll just stop striking and we'll be with you. And it works.
Interesting. It's fascinating. What other kind of, so we have like the industrialization and the more rural types, and then we have this huge wealth gap with the aristocrats and everybody else, basically. Were there other kinds of culture clashes going on at the time that are maybe less well known?
There's a burgeoning women's movement as well. So there are plenty of women who basically say they vote. So that's more of a more of a middle class thing, I would say. And then you have a working class women's movement at the same, people pushing for better working conditions, same wages, and so on and so forth. There's also the sort of more the urban and rural divide as well. So there are plenty of people who think that they're kind of cut off from the cultural developments that are going on. You have, you know, new cinema, new kind of culture and quite a modern things like, you know, modern art that's beginning to develop, those kinds of things. And people in the countryside are cut off from that and are looked down upon often. Because if you haven't got a train line, say, and you're being established right now, you're cut off from all of that. And
So
this is also something that I think is neglected for too long, and that the right is often able, the political right is often able to kind of use, in the sense that, you know, they can speak to these farmers and people in rural areas and say, you know, we're looking after your interests. So that's also a big divide. Really, every parameter that you can think of, there's quite a stark polarization going on before 1914.
Yes. This is so fascinating. If you are interested in before the World War One politics and kind of maybe what led up to it, I would definitely recommend this book. Again, it's Blood and Iron, The Rise and Fall of the German Empire, 1871 to 1918, and it is by Katja Hoyer. I want to thank you again so much for coming on the show and answering all these questions.
Thank you.